South Africa. You've been sleeping far too long. Wake up, South Africa. Now come along and sing this song. Wake up, South Africa.
Everyone, please accept my humble obeisances. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. My name is Babita, and I will be the host for today's session. So thank you all so much for joining today. We have a very wonderful guest with us today, Her Grace Urmila Devi Dasi, also known as Dr. Edith Best. She has served ISKCON continuously since her initiation by Srila Prabhupada in 1973. She and her husband have been in the Vanaprastha order since 1996. They have three married children, 14 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandsons. She has a PhD in education, was a primary and secondary teacher for 27 years, and has 19 years of experience with school management. Mother Urmila is the chair of the Shastric Advisory Council to the GBC, was an associate editor of the Back to Godhead for 30 years, and formerly a professor of sociology of religion at the Bhaktivedanta College. She travels worldwide teaching Krishna consciousness. She's also the author of Essence Seekers, Dr. Best Learn to Read, an 83-book literacy program, as well as the Great Mantra for Mystic Meditation. So as you can see, we have a very, very special guest with us today. Before I hand over to Mother Urmila, I'm just going to go through some house rules. I ask that you may kindly please turn on your cameras and keep them on, as this creates a very welcoming and personable session. All mics are muted and they will remain so until 14:45 South African time for questions as well as comments. So please raise your hand if you want to be unmuted. Alternatively, you can type in any questions and comments on YouTube, Facebook, as well as the chat on Zoom. And then the questions will be attended to thereafter. So thank you so much for joining us today, Mother Urmila. Thank you so much. I just wanted to confirm if you will be able to share your screen with us.
Yes, it's okay. It's been set up.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much, Hare Krishna.
I don't know why it's getting that. 1 second, just let me get back here. Sorry, just a second for me to set this up. Okay, there we go. Excellent. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pacharani Nuvasesis and Nuvadi Paskatyade Satarani Manchakapa Jumbashtarki Pasindabhya Bhattapati Janam Pavanevyo Vaishnavayam Namaha. So it's the 17th of October, 2021, from South Africa. And we're looking at our struggles with Maya. Is there hope and how? How do we deal with things that are opposed to Krishna consciousness. So as we know of the six symptoms of surrender, one is to accept what's favorable. So that means, you know, to chant Hare Krishna, to worship deities, to take Krishna prasadam, to hear the Bhagavatam and other scriptures, to associate with devotees. We accept these things as favorable, make our home a holy place or to visit holy places. And then we're also supposed to reject what's unfavorable. So that's eating meat, fish, eggs, intoxication, illicit sex, gambling, and things that interfere with our Krishna consciousness. But Maya is very strong. Daivi Esha Gunamayi Mama Maya Durachya. Durachya, dur means difficult. That Maya is very strong. And we have been associated with Maya for a very, very long time. Since time immemorial, Srila Prabhupada would say. We cannot remember how long we've been associated with Maya. So we're accustomed to following her dictations. And I'd like each of us to think about, you know, there are certain things which are good to give up if we want spiritual life, and we probably gave them up very easily. Maybe it was nothing to give them up. And I always use the example for myself that I never gambled. I don't recall ever gambling. Maybe I did in some child's game when I was six or something, but I have no recollection of ever gambling. And other people are addicted to gambling. So for me, having the rule no gambling, it was extremely easy. In fact, there was no change in my life at all. It was so easy. Or giving up eating meat, fish, eggs, onions, and garlic. Again, that was very easy. And I know other people for that it wasn't easy. I know one devotee that he said it took him 2 years before an Indian gentleman who lives in Europe to become a vegetarian. So let's think about some things that have been very easy for us. Maybe so easy that there was just nothing to it at all. You know, we just had no... like I say, nothing to it at all. Just, well, that was easy. And then there may be other things where it was somewhere in the middle, where we were able to deal with it and we were able to let go of it, but maybe it was some struggle. Maybe it took some time. Like this devotee I know that took him 2 years to be a vegetarian. He became a vegetarian, but it took him time. Difficult. And maybe even today there's things that we're giving up, but it's difficult. Our mind is going, don't you want me? Like for some of us, maybe that's criticizing other devotees or gossiping or, you know, spending our time arguing on social media or something like that. So maybe we don't do it, but it's hard. The mind goes, oh, you've got to do that. And and then there may be other things that we seem to be losing the battle, where we've tried for years and years and years and years and years with some bad habit, whether it's a gross bad habit, like intoxication, or whether it's a subtle bad habit, like gossiping about other devotees, and we really, you know, we just keep feeling that we're losing the battle. So we should keep in mind, something very important to keep in mind, is that the areas where I'm losing the battle for you may be easy. And the areas for me that were easy for you, maybe you're losing the battle. Or for me that's easy for you, it's medium. So we need to be very careful when we're talking to other people and when we're instructing other people that my easy may be your hard and my hard may be your easy and my medium may be your hard and my medium may be your easy and your medium may be my easy. I have a good friend who would say to people, oh, that's easy, that's easy, that's easy. And then she got very sick. And all of a sudden things weren't easy for her anymore. And she said she's convinced that the reason she got very sick was to give her some humility. All right. So Mayadevi is Krishna's energy that is very difficult to overcome. She's a Shakti, she's a person, and she's the energy that makes us see things separately from Krishna. Krishna defines Maya as whatever you see of value, if it is without relation to me, it has no reality, know it to be my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. So this is the definition of Maya, that Maya means when my consciousness is that I perceive something unrelated to Krishna. I don't see things as they are. Maya also means that which is not. I see things in the wrong way. And of course, the primary aspect of Maya is that I see that my body and my mind, which are both machines, a gross machine and a subtle machine, are my real identity. So if I'm thinking my body is my real identity, like I'm thinking I'm an old white American woman, or, you know, some of you may think I'm a young black African man. So when we think, you know, my body, that's my identity, and then we act according to that identity. Well, what does an old white American woman do? How does she behave? What does a young black African man do? How does he behave? Or a middle-aged Indian woman, or, you know, we according to our concept of the body, we come up with what's right and wrong and what's good and bad. You know, what may be good for a young single Indian woman in Delhi may not be, you know, the right thing for an old married man in Peru. So we decide on our actions and we decide on our ideals and our goals based on the body that we have this lifetime. And the other is the mind. So we may identify where I'm a political liberal or I'm a political conservative. Hey, or whatever. You know, I'm very outgoing or I'm very shy. And we identify with that kind of thing. And then we think, well, what do shy people do? Well, what do conservatives do? I mean, it's quite interesting. I've seen people argue in favor of things that on the face of it are absurd. And you're thinking, why is this person arguing for this position? But it's because they're identifying themselves with the mind. They're thinking, I'm a conservative, and this is part of the conservative platform. So even though it's something that's absurd and ridiculous, I have to argue for it because it's part of being a conservative. Or I'm a liberal. You know, because I'm a liberal, I have to argue in favor of abortions because that's what liberals do. And it's like, what? You know, instead of choosing things according to what's actually right and wrong, we choose things according to our identification with the mind. So this is an aspect of Maya, thinking I am this mind. And Maya is in the consciousness. Chapter 14 of Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada says, Maya is only within the mind. That I am perceiving things improperly. I am perceiving things improperly. Now, I started out in the class talking about things like gambling and meat eating. So one might ask, well, couldn't one see those in relationship to Krishna? Certainly. But if we see them in relationship to Krishna, we would understand that there are certain things that if we do them, or if we say them, or if we think them, tend to push us to see the world not in relationship to Krishna. I mean, you can think of this in terms of any relationship that you have with any other human being. So if you can think right now, some close relationship you have, a friend or family member, or a co-worker, or a boss, or anyone you're dealing with on a regular basis. If you want to have a good and pleasant relationship with them, there are certain ways of acting and certain ways of speaking and certain ways of thinking that will help that and certain ways that will harm that. I'm sure we all know that's true. There's ways that I can understand and interpret how I'm dealing with somebody that will impair my relationship with that person. Or certain things I can do. Just like I know one married couple where the man grew up in a family where there was never regular mealtime. The family never sat down and had a meal, never, but they basically didn't sit down and have meals together. Somebody would cook, and then the food would just be sitting in the kitchen, and you could go in the kitchen and eat whenever you want, whatever you wanted, and that was it. And then the wife grew up in a family where the family ate meals together the vast majority of the time. And so she would want her husband to come and eat with her after she cooked. And he had a very hard time understanding why she would want that. In fact, she'd say, "Dinner's ready in 5 minutes," and he would start doing something that would take him an hour. And then she'd be all upset that dinner's cold. I had to eat alone. And he couldn't understand why that would be upsetting to anybody. He's like, "I grew up with the fact that food would be cold and I'd have to heat it up and then I'd eat alone, and that's fine." You know, that's a fine way for humans to be. And it took a few years of marriage before he realized that to his wife, it was very important to her that he eat with her and eat the food when it was hot. But it took him a few years to understand that. So you can say that how you eat and when you eat is neutral. It just is. If your wife cooks the food, then the food is in relationship to her, whether you eat it with her hot or whether you eat it without her cold. However, if you eat it without her cold, it was damaging the ability to see that the food was in relationship to her. So everything's in relationship to Krishna. Now, meat is just dead animals. And animals that die naturally, their bodies go into the soil and they feed various other creatures and so forth and so on. But if we slaughter animals and eat them, then we're not able to see the relationship of the animals to the Lord. So it's like that. So it's not that sex, Krishna says, "I am religious sex." And if sex is used in a particular way, then we can see Krishna. And if it's used in other ways, then it hinders our relationship with Krishna. It affects our consciousness. So the fact that Maya is only within the mind and Maya is only within the consciousness, it's not in external things. It's not that some external thing is Maya. But certain external things and certain behaviors have a huge effect upon our consciousness. All right, so what are we going to do in order to change our behavior and change our consciousness? How are we going to avoid those things that harden our heart, make our heart hard towards the existence of Krishna? I'd like each of you to make a little list right now. What are those things that seem to prevent us, for ourselves personally? This is not something you're going to share. This is just for yourself. What are the things in our life, whether activities, whether things we say, or ways of thinking, that separate our consciousness from Krishna, that separate our consciousness from the spiritual? And by the way, some of the things on your list might not be on other people's list. Some of the things that make it hard for me to remember Krishna might not be a problem for you. Let's just take a minute and write that down. Okay, so I hope each of you have written down at least one or two things. And if any of you are not ever in Maya, then you could write down something for those you guide. And what you see tends to hinder other people's ability to connect with Krishna. Now, we might ask, why does somebody who's spiritually inclined do things, whether behaviors or whether physical behaviors or verbal behaviors or thoughts or feelings that are hindrance in our spiritual life. Why is there this disconnect between our desire to be spiritual, our genuine desire to be spiritual, and our doing things, again, whether it's body, mind, or speech, that actually hinder our own ideals? It's quite fascinating why there's a disconnect for the vast majority of people between what they believe genuinely, believe is right for others and for themselves, and what they actually do. I mean, it's such a deep question that it's a question that Arjuna asked in the Bhagavad Gita. It almost seems as if we're being forced to do something that we know is wrong. Well, let's look at some. I think most of these are rather obvious reasons, but still, one might be people we work with. Now, maybe the people we work with put us under pressure to do things that we know are against our ideals, that we don't believe in. And in some parts of the world, I've heard, like in Korea and Ireland, it's really extreme. Like, if you don't drink alcohol with your coworkers in those countries, it's hard to keep a job. So there may be certain standards at work where, you know, it's hard to keep your job if you don't go along with what's happening. It might be family. Now, maybe there's pressure from the family. And this is not just gross behaviors. It can be ways of talking. It can be ways of thinking that, you know, hurt you spiritually and other members of your family. Maybe their expectations, right? The family may be putting us under so much pressure to try to have a lifestyle or a way of thinking or a way of being that we know hurts our spiritual life. And maybe friends. You know, if we're going to school, maybe other students, the other students, or the other friends that may also be pressuring us. You know, it may be difficult to survive socially if we don't do things that are spiritually harmful. And I'm sorry to say that these friends can also be other spiritualists. You know, there can be pressure from other people in our spiritual circle, in our spiritual organization, our spiritual sangha. There may be people there who like to criticize and like to gossip or have a particular way of looking at the world in terms of, you know, victim and perpetrator, and they're constantly in a victim mode. And that may be pushing us into a mentality that is opposed to our spiritual life. And finally, it may be our own mind. It may be ourself. We may be our own worst enemy. As Krishna says, the mind can be the friend or the mind can be the enemy. It might be our own past bad habits. So maybe before taking up spiritual life, we had so many bad habits. Again, maybe bad habits of mind. It may be bad habits of speech, bad habits of actions. I mean, I know some people who have a really bad habit of mind where they really perceive the world as friends and enemies. They see other people's actions as being out to get them. And they're frequently in states of fear and anxiety and criticism. And this, you know, there are certainly other people in their environment that encourage that. But it's their own bad habit of mind that prevents them from seeing the relationship of the world to Krishna. All right. So we're going to come up now with solutions. And for these solutions, we're going to start at the highest level, the most spiritual. And then we're going to gradually, as we look at various solutions, we're going to go down to lower and lower levels of solutions. So we're going to start at very high spiritual solutions, And then we're going to go to what I would call practical, as Prabhupada called the techniques of spiritual life. And then finally we're going to go down to things that are in what we call sattva-gun, as Srila Prabhupada would translate it, the mode of goodness. Sat means existence or truth, and twa means like-ness, like truthness, or goodness, or existence-ness. All right, so the highest level is of solution is what we call sadhu-sangha, associating with other spiritually minded people. Now, as I already mentioned, this may actually be a problem if the spiritually minded people have also these same tendencies that we're struggling with, and they may exacerbate our own tendencies. So we have to also choose within the Sangha, within the association of devotees, we need to choose people who are going to encourage us to give up our bad habits without judging us, without condemning us, as friend or as guru, who are going to be able to say, hey, this is not in connection with Krishna, this is going to hurt you, and I'm going to be a buddy to help you with this. So just like with this devotee I was mentioning, who has this tendency to see that everybody's out to get her, so I said, why don't you keep a gratitude journal and every day tell me what you're grateful for? Or I have a very good friend that whenever I'm disturbed about anything, I go and I talk to her, and within 3 or 4 minutes we're talking about Krishna instead. So I may go to her and say, oh, this happened, that happened, and I'm upset about this, and what do I do about that? And pretty soon we're talking about Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes. And so she gets me out of my maya. So to have some devotees with whom we associate with, and we see this throughout the scriptures. When Arjuna is disturbed, of course he goes directly to God. But we see in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we see in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that we see in the works of all of our great acharyas and teachers, that devotees have friends and guides that they can go to for help. And just, of course, being in a sangha of devotees is very helpful. So if the group or sangha of devotees you're with, they're all vegetarians, they're not having illicit sex, they're not eating meat, they're not gambling, then it's not likely that you're going to do those things. Right? If that's not the norms of our group. And there's evidence that we will pick up on the norms of our groups, even if they're very geographically distant. Like, people are more likely to be overweight if they have a lot of friends who are overweight. That becomes what's normal. Or they're more likely to smoke if they have a lot of friends who smoke. They're more likely to go exercise if they have friends who exercise. I mean, this is just how it works. It's what's normal. It's what's expected. So if we have a lot of friends who are practicing spiritual life, then we're more likely to do that too. Now, our only ultimate cure is to change our identity. We started out in the beginning that the main thing of maya, what is not, is that we see our identity in terms of the body or in terms of the mind. We need to see our identity as soul. Then we will naturally do and say and think and feel those things that are in relationship to the soul and are good for the soul. And we will naturally not do those things that are not. But as long as we think that we are this body or we think that we are this mind, then we're going to decide on our behavior, speech, and mind in a different way. And that doesn't mean that a spiritual person doesn't do the activities that are normally done by somebody with their body and mind. You know, if you've got a wife and children, you become a spiritually enlightened person. You're probably, not always, but probably still going to do your responsibilities in this world, but you're going to do them not because you're a husband and father. You're going to do them because you're a servant of the Lord, and that's a service that you've been given. And that changes everything. If I'm doing it because I want to be a good husband, or a good father, or I'm doing it because I want to be a good servant of the Lord, changes everything. So the next thing is to get the real taste. This is called Param Drisva Nivartite. This is a difficult thing to explain and a very difficult thing to accept. This is a way of changing our behavior that, although it works very well, people tend to resist it very strongly. We tend to tell ourselves that the behaviors, speech, and thoughts, feelings we have that harm us are things we're being forced to do that don't do anything positive for us, and that we don't really want to do them, that we're doing them against our will. Again, Arjuna had this conception, which he presented to the Lord. You know, the reason I'm doing this thing, or saying, or thinking this thing, I don't want to, but I'm being forced. I don't want to be angry at this person. I'm trying to stop being angry, but I'm angry anyway. I don't want to eat 5 portions, but I'm being forced. The reality is different. The reality is that I am choosing to do these things, or say these things, or think these things, because I believe that they give me some kind of benefit. And the benefit that we believe we're getting is called in Sanskrit rasa. Rasa means taste. Some kind of experience of pleasure. And that those experiences of pleasure can have 12 varieties. Here we see the 5 main varieties. Neutrality. I get some pleasure from admiring someone. Admiring an Olympic athlete. I'm admiring a hero that saves a little girl from the fire. I'm admiring the musical composer. I don't know them, they don't know me. I don't do anything for them, but I admire them and I get some happiness from that. Then I get some happiness from serving. I get happiness from helping others. Even sometimes helping people I don't know. That's what, you know, firefighters, police officers, doctors, nurses, I mean, they help people that they really don't even know. But the happiness of serving others. Or, you know, you're an artist of some kind, whether, you know, a dancer, dramatic performer, painter, musician, and you're bringing pleasure to people that you don't know. Your life isn't bringing pleasure to people. Your life is in service. And then there's friendship. We get a great happiness from friends that we can just relax and be ourselves with. Right? Do fun things with that feeling of equality. And we get friendship from caring for others who are like our children or our students. Being a benefactor. And then we get happiness from our romantic relationships, sexual relationships. So those are the 5 main tastes. And then there are 7 secondary tastes. We get happiness from comedy and laughter. We get happiness from wonder and awe. We get happiness from sadness. Huh? What? We get happiness from sadness. What? That's why people watch sad movies. You know, was it a good movie? Oh, it's a great movie. I cried the whole time. That's also compassion. We get happiness from sportsmanship. Playing a good game or watching a good game where people are equally matched. Who's going to win? Am I going to win? That sense of sportsmanship. That also includes giving charity and acting righteously. We get happiness from anger. That's why people go to political rallies. It's also why people go to sporting events, to enjoy being angry. We enjoy being outraged. A lot of what's on the internet is to, a lot of why we watch, read, and participate in things on the internet is because we enjoy being angry and outraged. We enjoy being afraid. All of the scary movies, the scary rides at the amusement park, the extreme sports. We enjoy being afraid. And we enjoy being disgusted. Like, oh, that's disgusting. Really? Let me see. We enjoy being appalled. And you can see there's some relationship between anger, fear, and disgust. I can be angry because I'm afraid. I can be afraid because I'm disgusted. I can be angry and disgusted. I'm disgusted at this person's behavior, and therefore I'm angry at them, and so forth. And we enjoy these things. If we didn't enjoy these things, we wouldn't do them. And so the cure here is finding out, and this is difficult, it takes some humility, some honesty. What pleasure am I getting from this? What am I tasting? And then find the spiritual equivalent. So for those of you listening who are have been practitioners of bhakti yoga for some time, and if you know the scriptures, so a very easy technique, Prabhupada says that we should be systematically training people in the techniques of spiritual life. So one technique of spiritual life here is you figure out, what am I feeling? You give it a name. I'm feeling, you know, upset, hurt, afraid. And then you find something in the scripture that's similar. Because everything, Tato Brahma Jignasa, we inquire into the absolute truth, because Janmanyasya Nitaha, everything is coming from the absolute truth. Whatever we find here, as above, so below, it exists in the spiritual. And then we meditate on the original. So I can give an example in my own life. So a few weeks ago, I was feeling some anger and frustration and helplessness at one friend of mine who was making, in my judgment, excuses. This friend of mine said, what would you like from me, Urmila? And I said, you know exactly what I would like from you. Why should I even say it? And my friend said, well, I would do it if I could. I have this reason and that reason, the other reason. And I was feeling very aggravated. This person is just making excuses. If this person really wanted to do this, they would do it. And I'm like, okay, what is there in Krishna's Leela like this? And I thought, when Krishna goes to Mathura, the residents of Vrindavan, he's telling them, I can't come back because I have so many demons to kill. I have to please my family. And they're thinking, oh, he's just making so many excuses. If he really wanted to come, he could. He would come. And I started meditating on their mentality. And then my materialistic mentality just dissipated, just like fog in the sunshine. So this is a very easy way once you get used to practicing it. But it requires honesty about what you're trying to enjoy right now. That's very difficult with the false ego. And it requires some knowledge of what is in the spiritual realm. Okay. So this is this slide is a gross level, replacing a mundane taste with a spiritual taste. So instead of eating tasty mundane food, I eat food offered to Krishna. Instead of listening to mundane music, I listen to music about Krishna. Instead of seeing attractive material bodies, I see the body of the deity. Instead of smelling wonderful things for myself, I smell the flowers and the incense offered to Krishna. Instead of touching soft things, I touch things in relationship to Krishna. And whatever I would do in the world, I find some equivalent of what I would do for Krishna. So this is on the behavioral platform, but such should also be done on the platform of speech and mind. All right. Next technique is that of detachment. So this technique can be used along with the previous one. If it's used along with the previous one, it's a high-level technique in bhakti yoga, where you switch from what are you trying to enjoy in this world, you switch to Krishna. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 14:22, he who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they appear, nor long for them when they disappear, who is unwavering and undisturbed through all these reactions of the material qualities, remaining neutral and transcendental, knowing that the modes alone are active. So if one only does this, if one doesn't also bring one's mind to Krishna, then this is a little lower level technique. And this is a technique that is used by all classes of spiritualists. So even the impersonalists, even the voidists, this is a technique of spiritual life that is common to all of them. What we add in bhakti yoga is we then turn our mind to Krishna. And that is this neutrality, remaining neutral. When there's illuminating thoughts and feelings, when there is thoughts and feelings of attachment and material enjoyment, when there's thoughts and feelings of sadness, depression, helplessness, hopelessness. So these thoughts and feelings, we just let them pass by us. We don't hate them. We don't desire them. We don't hate them. We don't desire them. We don't try to express them, nor do we repress them. So if our body and mind fills with illumination, we let it and we let it go. If our body and mind fill with some strong attachment or hatred, we just let it be and let it go. If our body and mind fill with some kind of sadness and grief and despair, self-hatred, we just allow it and let it go. We don't get into it. We don't say, well, of course, this is why I should feel this way. Nor do we hate it and try to get rid of it. Another way Krishna describes this is in Bhagavad Gita 2:20. A person who's not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled but is always still, can alone achieve peace, and not the man who tries to satisfy such desires. Getting this mood of an observer. The Buddhists call this mindfulness. Observing without judgment the thoughts and feelings that pass and desires that pass through the mind. Observing without judgment, allowing them to pass, not trying to get rid of them, and not trying to grab them. So if this is used by itself, it's a lower technique. If it's used with then finding the equivalent in Krishna, then it's a higher technique. Okay, again, we're going down to train an incompatible behavior. So this is explained by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita 6:17. He's regulated in his habits of eating, sleeping, working, and recreation, can mitigate all pains by practicing the yoga system. Okay, so if there's a certain time of day, you can read books about habits. There's a lot of good books out there about habits. If you have some bad habit, you know, every day at 6 o'clock you sit down and play a violent video game. And then you can train yourself to do something that is incompatible with that. So every day at 6 o'clock, get together with a friend and have a kirtan out of your house. You're going to be away from your computer and you just simply won't be able to play a violent video game because you'll be with your friend having a kirtan. Or, you know, you'll be working out in the garden. Or you'll be, you know, you do something that where the bad behavior is not possible. Even like if you have a tendency to criticize and instead you train yourself to glorify. So whenever your mind says, you know, I'm going to say something nasty. Instead, you say something nice. So you train yourself to do an incompatible behavior. You train yourself to do something where the bad behavior is not possible. So this means developing other habits. Maybe it means developing different devotional hobbies that you can do. In the Prabhupada's purport to Bhagavad Gita 247, he says, as far as prescribed duties are concerned, they can be fitted into three divisions, namely routine work, emergency work, and desired activities. So desired activities, do something for Krishna that you really want to do. And again, one can study about habits formation, that there's some kind of cue or reminder. There's our routine habit, and then there is the reward. So we don't have time to go into this in depth. If you're interested in this technique, as I say, there's many good books out there about habits and changing bad habits, replacing a bad habit with a good habit. So basically, you're changing number two, the routine. So the same reminder and the same reward or a similar reward and a different routine. So certain way other people behave. Or like, let's say, you know, when people insult me, that's the reminder. The routine is that I insult them back, and the reward is that I feel powerful. So instead, when people insult me, I can remain silent, which gives me a reward of feeling powerful. And that makes sense to everybody? So I have the same reminder, somebody insulting me, and the same reward, feeling powerful, but I've changed my routine from insulting them back to being silent. So this way one can change one's bad habits. Alright, going down a level, to reward the absence of the behavior. This is rewarding yourself for baby steps. So someone insults you and you're silent, and just even in your mind you go, yay, I was silent. You know, or one day you don't play your video games. You go, yay, I didn't play my video games today. You could even keep a record of this. Just baby steps, baby steps, baby steps. To keep in mind that Srila Prabhupada says that learning bhakti is like learning how to walk. And parents reward even the first step. You know, the baby takes one step and they call the grandparents and the aunties and the uncles and they're, oh, she took a step. And nobody minds the times when the baby falls. They only celebrate the times when they take a step. So instead of feeling guilty and angry at ourselves for the times we mess up, we reward the times we don't mess up, even if they're very small. So this is switching our mentality from trying to get rid of the bad habit to rejoicing whenever we don't do it, whatever that habit may be. Now, this is another very peculiar one. And it's one that people often resist, but it can be very effective. And that is, we put the bad behavior on cue. We give ourselves a time and a place where we can do the bad habit. And Krishna certainly does this. Krishna certainly has provisions in the scripture that, you know, you can eat meat if offered certain kinds of animals killed to the goddess Kali, and you can drink liquor at this kind of time. And, you know, there's certainly provisions like that. We do this with children. We say, all right, now it's a break time. You can run around and scream. There was a program here yesterday, a few hundred devotees, and the little children were outside running around and screaming. And one of the mothers said to me, I can't believe they can do this for 3 hours. And I'm like, yep. You know, but when you have the children in school, you want them to sit, you want them to be quiet, and then you say, okay, break time, go run around and scream. So I know one couple who was arguing a lot, and the way they stopped their arguments was they said, we're only going to argue between 6 and 7 at night. And by 7, we have to stop. So whatever arguments we have, we're going to save until then. So that's what they would do. They would save their arguments, and then at 6 o'clock, if they would sit down, and then you had to actually argue at 6, otherwise the mind wouldn't accept this. Of course, after a while, They had less and less and less and less and less to argue about, and it became less and less interesting. You can do this with your mind wandering during japa. You know, you can say, all right, you know, at 9 o'clock, I'll think about this, right? Right now, I'm going to chant, and at 9 a.m., well, I'll sit down and worry about this. And then do it. Then sit down at 9 and actually think about it and write down your worries. And eventually it becomes less and less interesting. And in the absence of the cue, it goes away. Another way is to take a vow. This can include any combination of what we have done so far. So you take a vow that, you know, I won't look at my phone when I'm chanting, or I won't respond to arguments on the internet, or I won't play video games, or whatever it will be. I won't eat stuff from the shop with onions in it, or whatever your thing is. And Bhaktivinoda writes about doing this technique. So first you take a vow for 3 days. And it should be something that you reasonably know that you can keep, otherwise it's going to be discouraging. So, okay, for the next 3 days, and one can do almost anything for 3 days. You know, okay, I won't play video games for 3 days, and especially if you can substitute something else. I'll work in the garden instead, you know, I'll go for a walk. And then after 3 days, you reevaluate it. You see, did I like that? Did it work for me? Was I able to do it? Was it much of a struggle? And if it doesn't work, then that's it. You just did it for 3 days, and maybe you try something else. Maybe you stepped out a bit. If it did work, then you can take another vow for a week. And then the end of the week, you evaluate it. Did I like it? Did I help it? And then you can do for 2 weeks, and then for a month, and then for 3 months. And after a while, it becomes a part of your life. Another thing you can do is you can destroy the situation. Now, this is the least recommended technique. Destroy the situation. You change your job. You move to a new place. You get married. You become renounced. You know, you make some big change in your life. You destroy the situation that is the external cause of what's going on. You change your ashram, you become married, or you become renounced, or you move to a new location, you get another career. The reason that this should be the last thing, it's the thing that often people want to do first. Let me just, you know, it's like my house is dirty, I'm going to burn down my house. Is that generally the problem is within us. So wherever we go, there we are. And we just simply bring the problem into a new situation. But sometimes this is an appropriate way to deal with a problem. And the last one, it's just patience. The last technique is just patience. We're in the process of bhakti. We're practicing bhakti. We've had so many other problems and maya already go away. Some easily with no effort. Some with a little effort on our part. Some with a lot of effort on our part. There's many ways in which we have advanced in the thing we're struggling with now. We know it will go away. Maybe there's nothing we should do other than to wait on the grace and mercy of God. So we talked about many different techniques, sadhusanga, changing our identity, getting a higher taste, detachment, spiritual hobbies and recreation, forming new habits, rewarding small steps, putting the problem on cue, taking vows, making big changes, and having patience and faith. So, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So we have a little bit of time for questions.
Yes, thank you so much, Mother Urmila, for such an informative session. I think what stood out for me as well is the fact that you provided some practical examples for us to use in trying to overcome Maya, and the fact that there's different levels to it, so you don't have to go from 0 to 100. So it's a little bit encouraging knowing that we can take baby steps, as you've mentioned, in trying to overcome Maya. So thank you so much for that. Now we'll be taking questions. So devotees, if you have any questions, you can type them in the chat box, or you can just raise your hand, and I will unmute you for you to ask your question. And I think while we wait, I do have some questions myself, so I will go. So the first question I had was, is it possible to reach a point in this lifetime where one is no longer affected or struggling to overcome Maya? Will the struggle always be there?
Oh, that's such a good question. Srila Prabhupada said, until the stage of nishta, or steadiness, there will be a hard struggle with determination, and after that, things are easy. You can think of it as you ride your bicycle up a hill, and then you get to ride it down the hill. So even after nishta, as long as we are sadhakas, as long as we are practicing devotees, which includes the stages of ruchi and ashakti after nishta, for those if you're familiar with these terms, there's still some effort that is made. However, the effort that is made in nishta and in ruchi is not a big effort. And the effort made in ashakti is almost negligible. But there's still, as long as we are sadhakas, there is still some effort. There's still something intentional. It's not just flowing. So until nishta, it's quite an effort, at least for some things. And again, the things that you're making a big effort with for me may be nothing. And the things I'm making a big effort for you may be nothing. So do keep that in mind. And at nishta and ruchi, at steadiness and in taste, the effort is slight. You can think of it like you're keeping the car on a highway in its lane. And you have to make some effort to keep the car in its lane, but generally that's a slight effort. You're not making some huge, you're not having a war with your steering wheel. You do have to make adjustments, but they're slight. And then imagine you're in a self-driving car where you really don't have to do that. So that's bhava and prema. At bhava and prema, one is no longer a practicing devotee. Now, even at bhava and prema, one, as long as one has a material body, there will be desires and thoughts and feelings within this material body. There will be. And one could always make the choice to embrace them. It's not that you couldn't make that choice, but there's really no battle and no effort at all to make the right choice in bhava and prema. I mean, even if you think about at this point in your spiritual life, I would assume that for the majority of people listening to this, that we're vegetarians and that it's not a battle to be a vegetarian. I mean, maybe it is for some people, but I'm going to assume that for most of us, it's not. That even if we were eating meat previously to taking up Krishna consciousness, if we go past a meat restaurant, we're not having a battle with our mind. It's our emotions are flat. You know, we don't hate the people in the meat restaurant. But it's just, there's no interest. There's no pull on us. So it's like that. One gets to that point with everything. They're there, but there's no pull. I mean, another very simple example is, you know, if you're walking down a busy street, a busy city street, and there's so many people there, and maybe animals and dogs, things like that, and there's so many signs, so many shops. So if you have a very clear destination that you're trying to get to at a specific time, you're not distracted by what you're walking past. If you're just walking down the street without any place, and then, oh, look at that in that shop window. Oh, look at that in that shop window. Oh, look at that beautiful person. Oh, look at that ugly person. Oh, look at that dog. And everything is pulling you. But if you're like, I have an appointment, you know, I have an appointment in 10 minutes, and I've got to be over there, and you're very focused. You're still aware that there's shops, and there's people, and there's dogs, and you're aware of them, but you're not being pulled toward them. another way of explaining this, and I'm going to put this in the chat box, and this is what's explained in education. So there's what's called unconscious incompetence, then conscious incompetence, and then there's conscious competence and unconscious competence. So this is true when we learn anything. So first, I don't know that I don't know. I don't know that I don't know. I don't know that I don't know how to find equivalent fractions. I have no idea that I don't know that. Then I become aware that I don't know that. Then I can do it, but I have to do it deliberately and have to think about what I'm doing, and then I do it automatically. Like, I was taught how to, what's called touch type. I was taught how to type without looking at the keyboard. So I can just type automatically. I don't even know where my fingers are going. That's unconscious competence. So unconscious incompetence is I don't know how to type and I don't know that I don't know how to type. It's just I've never typed. Conscious incompetence, I become aware. Oh, I don't know. Conscious competence, I'm typing, but I have to really focus. And unconscious competence, it just comes naturally. So in terms of Krishna consciousness, unconscious incompetence is I'm in illusion and I don't know I'm in illusion. I have no idea I'm in illusion. I have no idea that I'm lusty, angry, envious, greedy, prideful. I don't know that. I have no idea. Then conscious incompetence is very uncomfortable. All of a sudden I become aware, oh, wow, I'm envious. I'm proud. I'm nasty to people. You become aware. It's extremely uncomfortable. We usually try to get out of that state as fast as we possibly can. And most people try to get out of that state by becoming unconscious again. Yeah, I made a mistake, but I'm a good person, you know, right? But then conscious competence is also uncomfortable. It's not quite as uncomfortable, but it's uncomfortable. And this is the struggle part you're talking about, where, oh, I'm being envious. All right, what am I going to do to act non-enviously? What am I going to do to let go of this envy? And then unconscious competence, we're just naturally non-envious. So those two intermediate stages where I'm aware that I'm in Maya, but I can't seem to do anything about it, and when I am doing something about it, but deliberately, are both very uncomfortable. And that's what we call anista bhajana kriya. That's the practice of bhakti that is unsteady. And the way to get out of that stage as fast as possible, because you want to get out of that stage as fast as possible because it's very uncomfortable, is to be willing to face our difficulties and let go of them, because that's what's causing that stage. So that's a long answer, but I thought your question was so important that it deserved a long answer. Have we run out of time here?
I think we can allow me. We have about two questions. I saw Jagadananda Prabhu had his hand up. I see he put it down. So I'll just quickly ask him to unmute to see if maybe in you answering so easily he got his answer to his question. So yes, Jagadananda.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna dear Umila Mataji. Thank you so much for your class. I hope you don't mind. I'll keep my camera off because I'm in a place of unsteady network. Anista network. you kind of answered my question in your answering of Bhavisha's question as well. But more nuancedly, my question was about in realizing those moments, like you're saying, that we are aware that the certain thing is hindering our Krishna consciousness or is hindering our development in Krishna consciousness. Then you mentioned in your class about this taking the steady steps to address those issues. My particular question then comes into play is when we notice that, like for example, I've tried a few of those steps, you know, when you just take a few days to try a new initiative that maybe will oust an old habit, and then I find, you know, I'll be okay for those first 3 days, and then in the next week I fall back, and then there's no determination after that. When I realize that the desire to, in my case, you know, it's an intoxicant on the side of intoxication, right? But I'll last for the first 3-4 days, and then I realize that withdrawal symptoms are starting to kick in, and certain things are really pulling on me that my mind, in a sense, doesn't want to deal with both that and the struggle of keeping up a vow, which seems weak against that. And then what I've tried in those moments is then, okay, I displace myself from an environment which will make that addiction easier. So I isolate myself in a certain place, and again, that will give me some relief until, you know, I get back into a space where the influence or the distraction is closer at hand. And then it's just a matter of time until it steadily increases and overcomes my determination.
Well, I would say then, first of all, you might want to taper. You might want to take small steps and taper. And the other thing is to figure out what enjoyment you're getting, and to get that enjoyment in another way. I was reading about a great victory in Iceland with teenagers who were, the vast majority of teenagers in Iceland were getting involved with alcohol and drugs. And one of the main ways that they countered this was having them engage in team sports. First of all, at regular times with the team. It wasn't just, you know, there's a basketball hoop and you can go and shoot baskets. But also they wanted something that involved emotional and physical risk. So that if you didn't give them some outlet for emotional and physical risk, which you're looking here at the taste of fear and chivalry probably, so then they would go for emotional and physical risks in the intoxicants. And it worked. They brought the rate of teenage drinking and drug use down to 1% to 2% from like 60%. So, you know, what am I getting? Sometimes intoxicants are giving us artificial samadhi. I mean, it was fascinating. I know someone who has chronic pain and takes an opiate called tramadol. And when I was looking at the, and she's trying to taper off of it, and I was looking at the effects of tramadol, and I was fascinated that one of the effects, the initial effect of taking this drug, is a sense of detachment, a sense of mindfulness. And I'm like, wow. Mindfulness in and of itself is a painkiller, by the way. There was a recent study, peer-reviewed, controlled study published in JAMA. I posted it on Facebook. Hardly anybody looked at it. It was interesting to me that there was so little interest in it. That the practice of mindfulness, of just mental detachment from pain, is more effective at making the pain go away than drugs. So you can learn techniques, again, if the reason for taking the intoxicant is to get a sense of detachment, you can learn spiritual techniques that will give you that sense of detachment. If the reason is riskiness, then you can do things that are risky. There's things you can do for Krishna that are risky. Lots of things you can do for Krishna that are risky. They give a sense of thrill. You know, what are you doing it for? Are you doing it for a sense of samadhi? Learn how to meditate. And then meditate on the Hare Krishna mantra. Meditate on the deities. So find, what am I doing this for? What am I trying to get? What taste am I trying to get? And then you probably need to taper. You really probably need to taper and then celebrate wins. One thing that happens, and this is a very important point, a very, very, very important point, is if we're filled with guilt and shame and etc., of the times that we don't win, we're actually more likely, interestingly enough, to be reinforcing the behavior that way. Because when we're filled with guilt and shame about something, we don't like to think about it. We don't want to address it. And that prevents us from actually dealing with it. So better is to celebrate the wins. Even if you waited an hour longer before you took your intoxicant, that's a little win. Another thing, taper is to go down gradually. Another thing, that's you want to taper off intoxicants so you don't get withdrawal symptoms. So the opposite of tapering is cold turkey, which can cause great physiological symptoms that are so painful that a person wants to go back to the intoxicant. So almost, and another thing is, you know, go to a place that specializes in helping people get off of intoxicants. There are so many places that have that kind of specialty. They know how to give you support, and you are with other people who are also getting off of those intoxicants, and they give you support. They have, what are they called? You get like a buddy, a sponsor, they call. So you get a buddy that you report into, hey, you know, I'm feeling like having a drink, I'm feeling like taking this drug, what should I do? And they help you through that. So there's a lot that you can look at for that. And there is hope. There's so many millions and millions of people who've had problems with addiction to all sorts of intoxicants and been free of it. And there are people who've gotten free. We all know such people personally. And it is possible. It is possible. All right, last thing, I just wanted to take something that was in this, that was in the chat that I thought was...
Thank you, Mother Amira.
My pleasure. I thought it was a good question here. Okay. What is touching things related to Krishna mean? Touching the body of the deity in worship, touching the soft flowers that have been offered to the deity, the clothes that are going to be offered to the deity, embracing the bodies of the devotees. What with changing your situation, what if you're living in a space doesn't match your spiritual goals and lifestyle? Well, that's true on one level for all of us, because the material world doesn't match our spiritual goals and lifestyle. So keep in mind that you're not going to find a physical situation in this world that is 100% compatible with your spiritual life. That it's just not possible. You won't find it. You can find places that are mostly compatible, but you're never going to find a place that is 100% compatible. There's always going to be something. I mean, like right now, I'm staying in a temple ashram. I'm right on a temple property. I am a half a minute walk from the temple. And we had these disgusting bugs that were coming out of the ground that I was having to clean up every day that were just covering the bathrooms. And it was horrible. And then there's sometimes difficult people that I have to deal with in my environment. And I mean, there's just things. You know, I mean, just it's life. That you're constantly needing to something every time before even doing everything, wouldn't that affect the energy of your food? Yeah, if you're in an absolutely incompatible situation, you can try to change it if you can. But I usually say to people, put 90% of your energy into being Krishna conscious where you are, and 10% of your energy into trying to adjust your situation. Sometimes just moving a chair around can make your spiritual life easier. I mean, yeah, I've had that. You know, I just move my furniture around a little bit, like, oh, it's so much more pleasant for my Krishna consciousness. But if you put all your energy into that, if you think, I can't become Krishna conscious until I fix my situation, you'll never be Krishna conscious, because you'll never find a perfect situation. And please have that be, I mean, for minor things like moving a chair around, that's one thing. For major things, rarely is that the solution. Sometimes, you know, if you're 28 and not married, maybe you should get married. If you're 60 and you're not renounced, then maybe you should be renounced. I mean, so that might be the solution. But to jump to that as our first solution, I'm going to change the situation, I'm going to block this person out of my life, I'm going to get another job. You know, Maya is within one's own consciousness, ultimately. Okay, so I think we will end here, although we can have lots of good discussions. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much, Mother Urmila. Yes, so for those questions that were not addressed, I will be going through the announcements, so you'll be able to see where you can catch Mother Urmila on and ask the questions you have and probably many more. So thank you so much. The questions were answered so beautifully, and just the whole class was just really amazing. So now we will be going in.